Hey, good morning to everyone. This is Ex-Professional Podcast. The podcast is about explosion protection. And like we used to do, we invite people from the industry, from our industries, which is a niche market, as we used to say, who have knowledge, who have passion, who have experience. My today's guest is a very interesting guy, especially to me, but I believe you know him already. He is Mr. Chris Clooney, who is from Canada. And I can say today he's one of the faces, if not the one face, for dust explosion protection. Okay, so let us hear. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, Arpad. I'm really excited to be here today.
That's excellent, excellent. I really admire your time and energy. What's the time in Canada right now?
8:15. 8:35. We just sent the kids off to school.
So that's your free time. Yes. Okay. I really appreciate your time, Chris. As I just said during the introduction, you are working on the field of dust explosion protection. What makes you do this whole topic? What is your interest?
Yeah, thank you so much, Arpad. And a couple notes. I mean, I've admired the work that you've done for years with your various safety projects, you know, companies, organizations, not just going in and providing consulting to people in explosion protection industries, but software, understanding, education. You have probably the most blog posts, maybe second to us, on explosion protection online. So I just want to put a note there at the front of this, just saying I appreciate the work that you're doing in this industry, educating people as well. If explosion protection is niche, then dust explosion is even nicher.
Yeah, we can say that.
We don't do liquid. We're only solid particulate matter and fires and explosions involving that. So, but I know we both come with the same mission for this
topic. But let me interrupt you. There's a very one interesting topic, the hybrid topics.
Yes.
Okay, because then everything combined, everything in combination. Yes.
Well, and I have a couple. We'll probably get to some of the examples and case studies of why dust is such a challenge when compared. I mean, they're all challenging, but some of the unique things about dust that makes it more challenging. Well, answer your question. I mean, how I got into back in my job, we called them hierarchy systems, but explosions. I started back in 2009 as a co-op student with an engineering consulting company, and we were doing defense research for Canada. So we were working with Defense Research and Development Canada, analyzing detonation, explosion, blast waves, shock waves. And I was a simulation engineer and a consultant. So I was doing all the computer simulations for designing troops' helmets to avoid traumatic brain injury, improvised explosive devices. At that time in the world, the bad actors were shoving screws into explosives, and we want to know what the impact of that's going to be. Is it increase the impulse loading?
Must have been a very interesting experience.
It was. And if you thought I really couldn't talk at a dinner party now, I really couldn't talk to anybody at a dinner party back then. Underwater explosions, all sorts of stuff in that space. And I worked in that industry for 7 or 8 years. I started my academic research, my master's, and then my PhD was in dust explosions, so industrial accidents related to explosions. And I thought it was going to be easy. You know, a dust explosion, a dust deflagration is so much, the release of energy is so less rapid than a detonation, than a shock wave that results in a C4 or ammonium nitrate explosion. I thought the physics were going to be way easier, but there were two things that came out of that I didn't really appreciate before making that transition, which was eventually I moved from defense into industrial safety, which is what I do almost exclusive today. And that was industrial safety as an industry, as a practice, as a community, is totally different than defense research. And I always wondered why, but it comes down to funding sources. So in defense research, and I had an interesting conversation on our podcast, the Safety Science Podcast, with Dr. Dimitrios Kekogiannis. I'm not sure I said his last name right, from Fike Europe. But he was on the same path where he did defense research and then industrial safety. And he said the same thing. In defense research, the funding's there to get to the bottom first principle solution of something. So what is the scientific understanding of the physics and chemistry that are going on? Where in industry safety, it's much more funded by the industry. So it's much more focused on practical applications. How do we get a best curve fit to a venting equation? How do we get a best curve fit to flameless venting? How do we understand at a high level all the stuff happens in the box, in the enclosure? How do we protect the box? So that was problem number one, is coming in. There was none of the, there was probably 200 years in defense research about the basic science of what was happening. That wasn't there for industrial safety, for deflagrations, for gas and dust explosions. That was the first problem. Science was hired. The second problem was there's people involved. So in defense research, you weren't looking at, is this person going to make the right decision? Is this person going to be able to analyze the hazards? Are they going to be able to put the controls in place? Will they follow through? Will they do maintenance procedures? Will they check up on this? And so once I get into industrial safety, I realized, well, I can understand the physics and chemistry till the cows come home, which was hard and still is hard. But if we can't convince people, because people are people and they're going to do people like things, we can't convince people to be aware, to have the knowledge, to know who to connect, to move forward in the industry, we can't actually impact industrial safety. And I fell in love with that topic. So I have a PhD in chemical engineering. I love technical stuff, molecular equations and mass and multiple dimensions and all that sort of stuff. But I fell in love with the problem of how do we help people understand how to be safe at the end of the day, especially in these industries where it's not like slips, trips, and falls, where stuff happens every day. Explosion, although we'll probably get into it, they do happen every day. We'll talk about that. But to one person on one site, they may only see one in their career, two in their career. And how do we educate them then to be aware, to implement the safe systems and move forward? So that's the problem I'm trying to tackle since 2016, 2017, when I started my company, which eventually now is Dust Safety Science. How do we educate the market to move us all forward in safety? I haven't touched a math equation longer than 3 variables in probably 7 or 8 years now. So, and I hope to not touch any 82 variable equations in the near time future.
Yeah, that wouldn't be that much noise. So on the other hand, let me say, you just announced I'm a bit older than you, okay? And in the early 90s, okay, as I started my career, okay, I was told by the old experienced engineers that everything from the gas explosion protection you can solve with dust. Okay.
Yep.
So
I tried, by the way, for 3 years for my PhD. It's harder than it looks.
Yeah, I mean, that was a saying, and I can remember I was in a sugar factory in the mid of 90s, and they said, okay, no need to install here and anything, because what we have, we just need a high IP rate, okay, and this will solve the case, okay. And certainly within half a year it just blew up, okay. Luckily there was no one hurt, but it happened, okay. And still you just said a very interesting topic, awareness and education. And you also highlighted the two topics, defense industry and explosion protection. Okay, so that kind of terminology. And defense is about explosion, yes? Because there either we want to be protected or we want to explode something, okay? And certainly for the gunpowder, okay, let us be very direct. That's a powder, okay? That's a dust, okay? A format of dust. In Europe, back in Europe, we have a directive, okay? Which is strictly saying, depending on the explosiveness, okay, there shall be a requirement for EX assets, okay, within the industry, okay, or for their use, okay, the technology production whatsoever. On the other side, for some of them, just simple a temperature limitation, okay. So it's very interesting, and I can say a few years back in Hungary, for example, there has been a new faculty of engineering started, explosive engineering, okay, so the people who do these explosions, okay, and I was invited, okay, after 2-4 years struggle, I was invited to make a half a day education, and it was surprising, okay, surprising even for the dean of the faculty, okay, that how explosion protection, how deeply involved in the defense industry, okay. So that's a comment from my side, which even for me was a bit surprising. And you know, I've been into some NATO projects and was very interesting, okay. Defense industry is out of ATEX, okay, so this we can clearly say. But as soon as it comes to the realization, installation, operation, etc., etc., then EX is a must-have, okay, because that's a safety layer. So, and I do believe this kind of cross-referencing and information exchange would be very interesting between or among the separate global industries, okay, and let us look at the NEC, okay, in Canada. It's only talking about electrical safety, yes? There is no word about non-electrical safety, if I'm correct.
Yes, I believe you are.
So I do believe this is also something which needs to be changed. And I'm part of a few working groups in the US, and it's always interesting to listen, okay, how far we are from the non-electrical explosion protection. But everybody accepts and admits that this needs to be discussed, okay? So this should be subject of discussion, but currently not regulated.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example. I mean, when I think about it, and I've spent well over a decade now thinking about it, so it's like a big map, right? There's different pieces of the puzzle. So you have in industrial safety, typically we're talking about fires, conflagrations, explosions, which is what you and I are talking about, and then that's typically the scientific word for that would be a deflagration.
True.
And then a detonation, which there's all kinds of definitions that are different. For me, it's the reaction zones propagating faster than the speed of sound.
Correct.
And that's my definition. Some people say, anyway, there's all kinds of things, but the whole point is that math of reactive systems, from slow on seconds and minutes to slow on milliseconds and seconds to fast on milliseconds and microseconds, that's what keeps getting built. So in the defense industries, you're on one end of the map. On fire protection engineering, you're on the total other end of the map, and in minutes and hours, how do we solve getting people out safe? How do we solve emergency response? How do we avoid the damage to the building? How do we do those activities? In the middle space, which is the, you know, millisecond to second time, there's all the stuff we talk about, industrial explosion protection. The big challenge is I think we build the map every time and an incident happens locally. So if an explosion happens in China this week, there was a large explosion in, I want to say, Jiangsu province. I'm probably not saying it right. 8 fatalities, metal dust explosion. You can imagine that the locally in that space now, they're very much looking at dust explosion again. There's been all kinds. The point is we build that map, but the challenge is for industrial safety, industrial explosion, is we actually forget the map as fast as we build it. So because we're very reactive, we only respond to the incidents that happen. I'll give you an example, a real concrete example I pulled out of my email here. You mentioned sugar dust explosions. if you're in North America and you started, you know, if you're in the age bracket of maybe 30 to 60, a lot of consultants in that space would say, I started in combustible dust when Imperial Sugar happened in North America. Imperial Sugar was a large scale dust explosion in the US, in Savannah, Georgia, multi-fatality, you know, injured, I think 50 people, 14 of them fatally. And almost no one at that time knew sugar dust locally in that sphere, knew sugar dust explode. So I'm gonna read some numbers for you from this email that I sent the other day. The first sugar dust standard in the US was written in 1924. It says standard on preventing explosions in sugar and cocoa. It's written by the insurance groups at the time and FDA, and it was written because the insurance groups couldn't stop sugar factories from exploding. And it says move the dust collector outside. It says check the bearing temperatures to make sure they don't overheat, which is one of the contributing factors to Imperial Sugar. It says keep housekeeping, keep future dust levels down, make sure you clean up any spills. Basically the exact same stuff that would solve Imperial Sugar 84 years later. But that's not the only point that I want to bring across. The first standard was 1922. You mentioned an incident recently. I'll just read this list and maybe I'll go through the whole thing, or maybe I will, we'll see. Here's all the sugar dust explosions just in the US in the last 100 years, and I'll just read off some of them. 120 years. Philadelphia, 1891. I guess it's international list. Paris, 1908. Louisiana, 1906, 1909, 1910, 1913. New York, 1911. Indiana, 1911. Philadelphia and New York, 1914. Germany, 1916 and 1917 during the war. New York, 1917. Vermont, 1918. Chicago, 1920 and 21. Jersey in 1927, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 1930, Toronto, Ontario, not far from where I'm at right now, 1943, Michigan, 1945, back in New York and Louisiana in 54 and 55, respectively. And then that's all they have for the list. But, you know, I don't have any more data from 60 until we started tracking 60 years later. So my point is, well, that's the point. We're forgetting that map. We forgot the sugar dust explosions happened, even though it was known and a large, huge loss. And that happens for every material. It happens for wood, happens for coal, happens for rubber, happens for plastic. And so that's the summary that I want to leave off with on that map is, I think one of the challenges, we build the map as we go and then we forget the map over time. And I have some thoughts on why that happens, but that's the challenge you and I are trying to solve today, Arfez. How do we talk about it to avoid forgetting the map faster than we actually build the thing?
I do believe there's one very interesting topic, and I do believe you are the most professional, at least between two of us. I'm talking about your database, okay? Because this mapping you are saying, that's for sure shall be related to some kind of source of information, okay? I really admire your work in terms of this database, because I use it as well, okay? So we know that this database is, let me say, a legal source of information, how we can get educated and how we can educate not only ourselves but also our partners, our colleagues, I would say all these topics we are talking about, that's pretty much addressing one headline, and that's responsibility, okay? And because the responsibility is something which you can be judged about, okay? That's an easy to track. And whether it can be, let me say, an insurance company, or a legal jury, okay, or whoever, whatever, okay. So I have to say that I have complied, okay, with my experience, with the regulation, with the company's policy, whatsoever. How do you see, what is the usage, okay, the reading, okay, the reading efficiency of your database. Do you have any kind of feedback on that?
I mean, it's the biggest one in the world. Let's start there. At least in scope and depth, there are local ones. Like there's good track in Germany. There's good track in New Zealand. There's good track. There's some groups doing some really good track in Sweden. So it's not the end all and be all in the local jurisdiction, but it's the only ones looking at trying to do every, like, understand everything. But it's incomplete. I mean, maybe we capture, I think, 1/5 to 1/10 of the dust bowls that happen in the United States. And then in other countries were, you know, just a fraction. That being said, it's tremendously useful. So the reason, I'll give an example. In the same day, so people only remember what impacts them locally in their own jurisdiction, and only for a short time. So in the same day, I can have a telephone call with somebody in the West Coast, and this happened to me the other week. I had a phone call with somebody who works at a terminal taking coal off ships in Vancouver, western coast of Canada. And they said, we're only handling coal. It's not like wood dust where it's extremely explosive. And the reason they said that is in 2012, there were two massive lumber mill explosions in British Columbia. So that's very front of mind that wood dust is combustible dust. We'll get to that same day. I had a conversation with someone in Pakistan, and they had a large power plant explosion involving coal earlier that year. So front of mind, coal is very a big hazard. And literally they said, but you know, they were talking about some other parts of prison and lumber mills there say, oh, at least we're not handling coal. That's really dangerous, combustible dust. I would say the same day, I had the same conversation with two people, two different parts of the world. I'm thinking, well, if we could just get them to communicate, they both realize that, hey, they're both, depending on the product size, similar KSTs, probably similar ignition scenarios, different processes at the site when you do a hazard analysis, but they're both equally as dangerous dust. So that's the whole part of the incident. Is okay. Well, if we can, because they're infrequent, so that lump, that coal terminal doesn't experience explosion very frequently. Those lumber mills in Pakistan don't experience explosion very frequently. But if they look at each other and we're able to record it across the world, you can go, oh, that site actually looks quite a bit like ours. And you realize it's just a you know, it's like a roll in the dice game, and it's a 100-sided dice, and you have 100 rolls for explosion happens. But your profile of risk is the same for those two sites. And that's part of what the incident database is trying to achieve. We just released a new version of it at dustabscience.com/incidents/database. I think they'll both take you there. So you type in coal, you can type in plastic, you can type in a company name if you want. The purpose is not to shame companies, but it'll come up and say, we have in our database 20 explosions and 15 fires, probably the other way around, 5 fires and 20 explosions, 4. I'll do it right here. I'll do coal. What's coal say? So we've recorded 23 dust explosions and 38 fires involving coal, and then 10 more potential dust explosions at dustabscience.com. So you can use that as a research tool, right? So we started sending those people that didn't believe that coal was explosive and wood is the coal report. The people that believe coal is explosive and wood aren't the wood report. It's a way to educate folks on this stuff's happening every day in all industries that are handling burnable materials, we'll say. Materials that release calories when you burn them. And so that's one piece. And then the other piece is it gives us a way to dive into the data. What trends are we seeing that are causing loss? And that's really what our team does. We release the incident report every year, talk about, okay, these are what we're seeing. These are type of equipment, new industries, 3D print, whatever the new topic is, we try to identify those out of the data and bring those to the industry so that we can all move forward safely with them.
I would say, that makes the whole topic very interesting. Awakening project once we had, and that was like a turbine assembly, installation, whatever. And there was a huge ventilation system. And the ventilation system, you know, was sucking the air and moving out the facility. And there was a filter. And the filter certainly collected dust, okay? And at the time of the cleaning, okay, the dust blew up. Okay, so there was a dust explosion, and the whole ventilation system was collapsed, and nobody was ever prepared for it. Okay, so that's always a very nice marking, at least for myself. Okay, but at any kind of education, I'm always telling this story, that you can never imagine what is expecting you. Okay, so what might await you on the side. So especially I would say the ventilation system can be something very frustrating, okay, in a way. But on the other side, that's a must-have for work safety, for agency purpose, or even in terms of explosion protection, okay, ventilation system, gas detection, etc., etc., must have, and we need to have. How do you see people learn from your database, learn from the scenarios, and this is some kind of well-used source of information?
I think it is in a way, and the big challenge, it's that it's the forgetting the map, right? So the technical term is normalization of risk. So what's that mean? That's the, you and I know you have a couple more children than I do, but I got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old in the house before we drop them off at school and daycare. So normalization risk is when they leave a toy on top of the stairs, I see that toy and say, I should move that toy. It looks unsafe, so maybe it could trip. And if I don't move the toy, I might see it again and say, I should move that toy. If I go 2 or 3 times without moving it, it's a week later, and my mind stops seeing the toy, and I go, oh, the toy's still sitting on top.
You are used to it. You are used to it.
That's, yeah. Your mind as a human, as an animal, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, because of evolution, will block with stuff that doesn't cause loss. Even if that thing is actually truly dangerous, it has to, because it takes in so much information that it blocks and stuff, so that you're aware that the tiger over there is dangerous and the toy on the stair isn't as dangerous as the tiger. That's just normalization of risk. So what happens at a site where you are, if I rewind it back to even a test, I know you guys have a test lab in overseas in Hungary that does this type of testing. If you do an MIE test of metallic powder, aluminized flakes, or it doesn't matter what the powder is, you do an MIE test, once you get down to those limits, you might do 10 shots and have 2 explosions.
Yep.
So if you're an observer and you watch that, you could see it could go explosion, and then 8 no explosions.
Yep.
Or if you're observing, it could go 4 non-explosions, 2 explosions, and 4 non, or it could go 8 non-explosions and 2 explosions. And if you have 3 observers, the chance of them having those 3, they're calculated, but having those 3 experiences with the same set of tests, the same physical things happening, we'll say they're a third.
Yeah, what's the probability?
Yeah, well, but the problem is the person that sees the 2 explosions back to back, they're going to think that stuff blows up every time.
Yep.
But it's 2 and 8. So the other people that see 8 times in 2 or only do 8 tests and don't see explosions, they're going to think it never explodes. And the people that see it go non-explosion, I say, oh, it's explode sometimes. What's the problem with that? The problem is those probabilities, 100%, 0%, and 50%, have nothing to do with the material, the scenario. The scenario has a real probability. It's 2, it's 20%. But the perception of that scenario, that it happens every time, or it happens 0% of the time, or it happens half the time, has nothing to do with the dust, has nothing to do with the scenario. It's only what you observe. So coming back to normalization of risk, those people that see explosion sometimes or explosion none of the time are never going to move that toy at the top of the stairs, and they're never going to see that as perceived risk at their site. That's why you can see people trudging through knee-deep sugar dust for their entire careers, because they're just happy the group that's observed zero explosion. The other group that explosion, maybe they perceive more risk. But it's nothing to do with the risk profile of that actual material. It's just what you happen to see when you were observing the tests being done. And often in life, we don't do enough you know, you're not going to get 100 cracks at it to see what is the true probability. You're just going to observe
one or two cases. You don't have the time, you don't have the energy, you don't have the financial background.
It just doesn't happen because you're working.
Someone has to.
Yeah. And so this brings all the way around to your comment on gas and dust explosion. So I think this is the number one thing. I try to figure it out. Why is gas so different than dust? Why is gas, everyone knows, don't let it out of the pipes. Loss containment is a serious issue on a site handling flammable gas. And it comes down to the same thing. If you had a gas in that MIE device, you put a lid on it, put gas in it, it explodes 100% of the time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So any observer observing that gas in the MIE chamber, we all agree, it all explodes.
Yep.
In dust, every observer is different because they all see a different number of percentages of those explosions happening. We all disagree. We say it never happens, or it always happens. And that, when it comes down to the people, the human challenge, the education, in my opinion, that is the root of all those challenges in education. Now, there's science and technology and solutions and safe systems and implementation, but the human part, it just comes down to that. That's the difference between dust and gas. Gas, we all agree. You put it in the thing, 10 times out of 10, explodes. Dust, we don't agree. Some people say it never does. Some say it always does. Just depends on what you perceived happened in that device.
Okay, but I do believe it relates back to the physical characteristics of dust, because dust starts to lay down, okay? Starts to relax, okay? Gas starts to fulfill the whole applicable volume, okay? Which is present. And I would say that's an immediate differentiation. On the other side, you just highlighted a very important topic, and that goes about workplace requirements, okay? Here in all cases, we are talking about working places, okay? Your kitchen with cacao powder, if it explodes, it could explode, okay? We both agree on that. It will be never considered as an EX atmosphere, okay? Because that's your home kitchen, okay? That's your whatever, okay? Private ownership. But in a working place where you have the general manager, you have the CEO, you have the plant manager, you have the engineers, you have the technicians, okay, maintenance team, whoever. So they are employed. They shall be secured by the working regulations, okay? And the owner of the company has to deliver the proof of evidence that they have done all the possible precautions, okay, to have a safe working environment, which means I can enter, I can work, and I can go back to home to sleep, okay, and enjoy my rest of the day. And I do believe that's a very important and with a very high importance note. It makes the difference, because in that case, someone has the responsibility, okay? Someone has to stand in front of the jury and say, I've done everything. And that's black magic, okay? But this responsibility, let me say, you are my boss, and forced to do my job in a dangerous working environment, something happens to me, and then my family, whatever, lawyer, etc., and coming, and they say, okay, hey guys, this was not driven well, not managed well, then that's immediately references all the regulations, okay, we've been talking about, the databases, the engineering good practice whatsoever, okay? And, I've been to some incidents where people were counting on the insurance, okay? That they would refinance the new construction, the new building, the new developments. And then certainly the very first question of the insurance guy was about, do you have a hazardous area classification? Oh, yes, 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 we have. Okay, how old is this classification? Oh, around 10 years old, here you have, here you are. And then they say, especially in Europe, sorry guys, it has to be within 3 years. Okay, it must have been, it should have been revalidated. So that's not correct anymore. That's all your fault. No doubt, no question. Certainly, it will not give my life back, okay, or not even my working place, because that's all demolished. But I would say, you know, entering such a database or reading such a database should be with a very a block letter, exclamation mark, that it's all about responsibility. And responsibility is related to your position within the company, okay? And that certainly shall be driven by my working contract, okay? But so it is. We just had on LinkedIn a very nice posting today with few guys about the personal protective equipment, okay? If people give enough note on that. I do believe the same goes for any kind of safety related topic, and explosion protection, dust safety, science, etc. These are all safety related topics.
Yeah, I mean, there's two. So I do want to, I want to tackle the human challenge, the community thing that you're talking about here, but I want to put a footnote on the gas versus dust, because you mentioned a good point. And it's certainly not just, so the point you mentioned is that dust falls down and gas, most gas is still in space.
Yep.
If you run the numbers, what that does is that MIE test is actually over predicting a dust explosion in a real scenario. Say it was a silo that you're injecting, or a hopper that you're injecting dust in from, or pouring dust in from a spout. What that means is that that case only going to have an explosion 2 out of 100 times, said 2 out of 10.
Yep.
And the fun thing, if you run the numbers on that, is it makes that whole perception challenge way worse. Is that instead of 8 people disably not believing 2 people, you have 80 people not believing 2 people. And that's actually what we're in. So you and I, we're the two, we're the believers.
Yeah,
we're trying
yeah.
to convince the other 80, the other 98 people that, and so that's actually the real number. It's not 2 in 10 with a dust explosion. It's more
Let me say one comment, okay? I've been invited by one of a huge oil company, and the management was sitting on the opposite of the table, and they were asking me, okay, Arpad, we understand you. It's explosive, it's hazardous. Okay, what's happening if we don't take care about? Okay, because it's just too expensive. And I said, hey guys, that's a wrong discussion. It is hazardous, okay? And it is about the probability, okay, that it blow up, okay? And if it happens, then let us count the value of life. The value of your days within the boss.
We should make that point. But I don't know, you've been in this long time. Has that ever worked?
No.
Okay. Well, so that's my first, like, yes, that's what we're here for. But I would say that there is another way to potentially go about this. If you can get them to agree to do this, I've seen it happen. It's usually got to come. There's two ways. Come from top down, leadership gets by, and then you do it. Or come from bottom up, you have a champion and bring this to an organization. So the real thing is, okay, well, let's just make sure we measure everything happens in the next 12 months, because they won't tell you. If you say, what happened in the last 12 months for fires and explosions, what kind of loss, what kind of loss of production? They'll say, none, because it's the same normalization of risk. Even though they may have an employee with permanent burns down the floor from the last time they had an explosion, they won't remember that. It's just, and that's not their fault. They're not bad people. That's just the toy on top of the stair issue again. If I was in their position and I only knew the information, I'd probably do the same thing.
We'll do the same.
If you can convince them that, hey, let's look at this critically for the next 12 months. Every fire you have that stops production, every time you have an employee injured and working comp or whatever it's going to be, let's actually measure that. Just the production stops alone are probably going to be millions of dollars. And then if you go to that conversation 12 months later, go, oh, well, why do we implement safe systems? Well, it's not hypothetical anymore. Hey, your production will upset. It's like there's actually $600,000 of shutdown production that we could have avoided had we last year started by putting an implementation plan in place to protect some of this stuff. Will it work at every site? No. The ones that have no loss, truly no loss, not the ones that say that no loss. But my belief is that any site that you go into that has that much dust or that much problems, it's probably having fires and shutdowns related to those fires, insurance concerns. There are numerators there that you can get an efficiency on. You have to convince them to actually measure it. And you can't do it retroactively because they'll just say, well, we never had that issue. not because they're bad people, just because people forget. That's how it works.
Yeah, that's correct. Let me ask you a very direct question. You act globally. I know this. And you are also part of many working groups I know about. How do you see the differences between or among the different countries, okay, or in global terms, regarding dust safety? We do have the IEC 60079 standards. We do have the 80079 standard related to explosion protection, okay, I mean. These are pretty much about explosion protection. There are NFPA standards. There are other regulations as well. So how do you see it? Does it work? Is there any bridging in between?
Well, I mean, there's definitely differences in the approaches, right? I think we can agree on that. So in North America, in Europe, you have standards and directives for personnel and standards and directives for equipment. We're sort of, depending on how you look at it and how you squint at it, maybe missing the equipment responsibility here in North America, and much more focused on owner and operators. So there's some technical things. And then you have Europe's very much has many more large test sites. So they're doing much more certification, a lot much more cutting edge research on do explosion safety valves work, this flame is bent. So they're doing these large scale tests. And then here in North America, we have a couple large scale labs. But you know, they're doing the testing they're doing. We have very much focused on that. So we're much more focused on, well, how do we implement a hierarchy of controls in a safe way? How do we educate people? Like, so there are some structural differences on how we've gone about it. And the worst part is both sides probably think they're doing it the best way because that's how humans work. And it would be better if we could communicate across a little bit more. And that's one of the things I'm doing, trying to be involved with these things. There's all that. But at the end of the day, I think it really just comes down to the same sort of cycle of remembering and forgetting. And so if I looked at all the lumber mills in Hungary and all the lumber mills in Canada and all the lumber mills in the US and all the lumber mills in Malaysia or whatever industry and did sort of risk profile analysis of all that whole industry, you got the histogram. If you like histogram how bad they probably look pretty similar. You know, there's some that maybe are really attentive, there's some that aren't attentive, but if they're different, they're only different in the small numbers, maybe 20% different, but 80% the same. So the risk profile in those industries are all probably quite similar. And then it comes down to how we're tackling it. I think that comes back to your challenge about, you know, insurance push, regulation, education, university researchers, the role they play, the role suppliers play, both of services and equipment. I think building that strong community within a country is really the best way to success. That's the only way we've had success. So we think of things like we'll call this a success because I think it is, although some people may argue, but the OSHA grain handling standard was put together because regulators sat down with the experts, sat down with the industry, everybody was at the table designing that approach. Now other people may argue that's, you know, we're 1980s, so 40 years in that, and there's other challenges that may be coming in, and certainly some of the large scale explosions we have recently. But my point is that community of bringing all the voices in is really the only way to solve those challenges, because if you have the experts get together and say these are the regulations, and then the government says, well, okay, let's get our sticks out and this is what we're going to prevent against, you're never going to move an industry. You'll just, because it's only one in 10 sites or one in 500 sites, it's going to be penalized. How do you move an industry by scaring them that one in 500 sites are going to be, it just doesn't work. So you need to bring them in on that conversation. And that comes around to building a culture within local regions, which is tremendously challenging. But I'll tell you what starts to build that, these conversations. You working out of Spain, Hungary, and Turkey, and you know, all the regions of the world that you're working in over there, us having these conversations in North America. And I mean, we're global as well, but less global than you. That's how you start to get these conversations going. So it's like, oh, this group is doing research on flavor spending in such and such a country. Maybe we don't need to rewrite the wheel. Maybe we'll just borrow from that. I think that's really the solution. The other day, are they different? I don't know. You might get sued in a different country in a different way, or you might get thrown in jail in another country for the same sort of, it's like, that's different.
that's for sure different. Let me ask you a very naughty question. What about cleaning? Because cleaning is a prevention tool for dust explosion protection. Yes, if there is no dust, no dust explosion. Yes, we can say that. So in the majority of all the industries related to dust, I found this as a very interesting topic. What is your opinion about cleaning? Okay.
It's a huge piece of the puzzle, for sure. So I usually say there's six elements. This doesn't map to any international standard. It's the only the thing I've sort of developed, but there's six elements.
No, there's no wording. There's no wording about it.
There's six sides to the hexagon. So you got to prevent, protect, isolate, contain, collect, clean. Those are I think that encompasses everything. Prevent, protect, isolate, contain, collect, clean. So if we're talking about the bottom half of that, contain, collect, clean, you want to keep the dust inside the equipment. That'd be ideal. Most of the time, there are cases where having the dust stay in the equipment causes explosion in the equipment. So, but you know, most of the time, we want to keep the dust in the equipment. Collection at points where the dust has to escape or is escaping. So has to might be a transfer point to from a vibrating conveyor from a chute. Okay, we can't, there's no way to mechanically contain that. So let's put dust collection there. Or it might be, okay, we don't want to invest in improving the holes in there, such and such, so we're going to put dust collection in. And then you got to clean. So it's a huge piece of the puzzle. And you'll often see that large-scale explosions, like ones that are, you know, 4 to 50 fatalities, being blamed on fugitive dust, so the lack of cleaning. And that is true most of the time. We'll say 80% of the time it's true. 20% of the time, you know, there's large-scale explosions, large metal dust explosion. Anyway, there's cases where the explosion had no fugitive dust and caused large loss as well. But those large dust explosions are by and large caused by fugitive dust outside of equipment. But you know what causes more permanent injuries? Like the long tail, the mom and pop. You have a fire in your dust collector and your son goes out and opens the access hatch, has facial burns for the rest of his life, which actually have a way more frequently than the blockbuster, for lack of a better word, 4 to 50 fatality explosions. Those aren't caused by fugitive dust as much. Those are caused by issues inside the top, prevent, protect, isolate, generally causing this. So some people you'll see come in and just go, here's my checklist. I do my hazard assessment, and it's a little different in Europe because the regulations are different. But here's my you have dust outside. You need to install dust collection. Hazard assessment done. It's like, okay, we covered part of the problem there. Maybe we prevented the large scale blockbuster disasters from happening. But what we see in our incident database is, I mean, the thing that kills the most firefighters, falling off silos, falling when exploded. So it has nothing to do with fugitive dust.
No.
It's an explosion in a piece of equipment knocking them off. You can clean the fugitive dust till the cows come home. If you're not have an emergency response procedure for how to deal with smoldering in your silo, and the firefighters don't know to not climb that silo, then that's going to be cause large loss. So there's other things outside of just fugitive dust. It's a huge piece of the puzzle. But some people say it's the only piece, and I'm like, no, it's not, because we see it, right? Permanent injuries, most permanent injuries are caused by the long tail. Permanent injuries are caused by other things than just fugitive dust. There are permanent injuries obviously caused by fugitive dust, but that's my take on it. It's a huge piece of the puzzle, but it's not all the puzzle. in my opinion. And some people don't.
I would say that that's a, you know, that's a not a one step business. Okay, so it's a step by step, a lot of steps together. And as you mentioned very clearly, I do believe was a very clear message. It's strongly relates on the understanding of people involved. Okay, and this is how we shall act. And I do believe this is where your work and your passion is really important to the whole industry, to make this available. Okay, first of all. You know, you are a young face to this old industry, and I would say that's also very important that people see that different ages, okay, are also interested into this topic, okay, even on academic level, but also on the level of the technicians, so on the floor, okay, where we have to deal every day, okay, and I used to say the best. One for the hazardous area, okay, to work in, who has at least 5 years experience and has a family, okay, to go back home, okay, because then he has the intention to take care about himself, okay, because that's self-awareness, okay, that's a self-education we have to do each and every day. I do believe you do the same, I do the same. We all need to do the same and educate ourselves and all the people around, because that's a huge mess, and that's not a clean industry. Okay, but look at the pharmaceutical industry. We say it's a clean industry, but even though, okay, so dust is even harsh. And we just agreed before for the podcast recording that. For some of the testing for any pharmaceutical dust, I can't remember, I was asking once 50 gram, and the manager told me, hey Arpad, 1 gram is like 1 million euro, okay, so what the hell, it will never work. So I never received anything, which means I considered it as the most dangerous.
I hope they don't burn up too much of it when they have enough.
Yes.
But yeah.
Yes. And the same goes, you know, for all the how to say, drugs people have, because that's EX as well, EX topic. So, Chris, I really admire and really thank you for your time, and it was nice talking to you. I do believe it was a very, very interesting conversation, awakening conversation, and hope to continue. Wish you best of luck, and enjoy your time.
Yes.
Without the kids being in the school, okay? Great to have you here.
No, I appreciate it so much, Arpad, and I appreciate you having me on for your podcast. And like I said at the outset, I've been watching. We've been talking over the last 4 or 5 years on this stuff frequently, I would say. And the breadth and depth of which you're tackling these challenges over across the world, and even here in North America as well, being part of groups and stuff, it's. It really is commendable, and I think it's making a difference. And my hope is the same thing with what we're doing with Dust Safety Science, with our conference and everything else, that we're trying to, that culture that we're trying to build, that's a piece of the puzzle. So I appreciate you. I look forward to getting this out. Maybe we can share it on the Dust Safety Science podcast as well.
Absolutely. Let's cross-reference as we agreed. Yes? Okay.
Certainly.
Have a great time, and have a great day, and greetings to Canada. Yep.
Thank you, Arpad. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.